Humanity is growing and connecting. Tomorrow's world needs more energy from more places.
But to find our net zero future, we must overcome the natural constraints of many new energy sources.
This is the Energy Transition Solutions Podcast, where we look at the energy challenges of modern life and the innovators finding solutions. Join us for a low-carbon, high-energy conversation with your host, Joe Battier.
This views of the host are his own and should not be viewed as those of any business, corporation, or government entity.
Hello, everyone. I need to add a disclaimer to the front of this episode. So this is a conversation that I had at CERAWeek by S&P Global. I am adding this disclaimer because this is a conversation with somebody who is under the umbrella of Mitsubishi Heavy Industries. So I just want to add that disclaimer. If there is ever a reference to Mitsubishi, that is a reference to the specific group in Mitsubishi Heavy Industries, either Mitsubishi Heavy Industries or Mitsubishi Power Americas. It is not to the standalone Mitsubishi. So I just want to add that so that everybody is clear and understanding. In this episode, we are talking about Mitsubishi Heavy Industry and or their subsidiary, Mitsubishi Power Americas. So with that, let's get into the show. All right. Hello and welcome to the Energy Transition Solutions Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Battier. This is the show where we bring you low carbon, high energy stories from the people solving the energy challenges of modern life. We are here recording at CERAWeek by S&P Global. And now I have on the mic Bill Newsom, President and CEO of Mitsubishi Power Americas. Bill, thank you for joining me on the show today. To start off, let's have you do a quick introduction to yourself an introduction to Mitsubishi Power.
Sure, absolutely. Joe, thanks. I appreciate this opportunity to be here and talk about a very important subject that we're working very hard to try to accomplish. So great to be here. And so just a little bit on my background. I'm mechanical engineer by trade from University of Florida. I used to design power generation equipment. I work for Mitsubishi Power now for about 20 years. And I've been the president and CEO for a little over 2 years now. And our business portfolio in the United States, we've grown from over a 22-year period from about 7 employees to almost 3,000 employees now to date. And almost about 1 million square feet of manufacturing and service facilities around the United States. So it's been a big growth for Mitsubishi Power Americas, which is wholly owned subsidiary of Mitsubishi Heavy. And so it's been a really fun journey as we have continued to grow in the power generation business and as we grow in the energy transition. When I took over about a little over 2 years ago, I had a 30-60, 90-day transition plan. On day 61, we reorganized the company into two kind of business portfolios. Our core business, which is all of the power generation, new equipment, service, our aero division, and our non-OEM MD&A division. All of that is our core. Most of our people, revenue come out of that. And then we started our energy transition business. And on the energy transition side, we have hydrogen development team. We have a PV solar development team. We have a battery energy storage integrator team. We have a business incubator team. And we are looking to also help our carbon capture team as we do GTCC plus carbon capture projects. So that's kind of our two portfolios that we work on. It's been a fun ride over the last 20 years or so.
Yeah, it Definitely sounds like it. And that sounds like some significant growth that has been occurring there at Mitsubishi Power. And of course, we're going to focus in on the energy transition portion of that. But I am curious from that larger perspective, mm-hmm. and specifically talking about that growth, have you seen that growth in any specific area of Mitsubishi Power and any specific initiative or anything like that?
Sure. Great question. I appreciate that question. We have a press release out just recently showing that Mitsubishi Heavy and Mitsubishi Power Americas has number one market share globally for large frame gas turbines. And so the M501 JAC is what we call it. Some folks call it the Jack turbine. It's a 450 megawatt gas turbine, one of the most efficient in the marketplace. So it's really a decarbonization solution as well. So it's a product that we've been very successful with, and we're currently leading the market as seeing a lot of utilities today. One of the challenges they have, and we've seen over the last 5 years or so, is utilities. We plan for a very flat demand growth, 1-3%, and what we're seeing right now with reshoring of manufacturing, industrial growth here, obviously the IRA and the BIL. Jennifer Grantholm's mentioned a couple days ago at this conference about the success that both of those programs have had in bringing manufacturing back. She said almost 600 manufacturing facilities in the United States have been announced. So that growth, as well as a big impact over the last maybe 12 to 15 months, is the AI database growth. We've had databases before, but the AI database growth is significant. Yesterday, heard from EVP from Microsoft on globally, every 3 days, another database center goes online, which is kind of mind-boggling when you think about it. And then the need for baseload clean power generation to support that, as well as industrial. So kind of being here a year ago to being here today, what's different in my mind is we were thinking a lot more the solution and answer was just renewables. And I think today, with this industrial growth and that were just mentioned there, and database centers, we have to have a way to have a dispatchable asset and then make that a clean baseload asset. So we're working on programs to do that, and hydrogen and carbon capture on the tailpipe are ways to bring that to life.
Yeah, well, it sounds like the way that you've laid out the overall growth of the energy market and the energy demands and needs in America almost lends itself perfectly to what you're talking about in hydrogen and carbon capture and that infrastructure integration component of mm-hmm. needing to connect to the existing infrastructure with this excessive amount of demand that we are getting. So I've had on Mike Ducker from Mitsubishi Power talking about ACES Delta. And when we spoke, we were looking at ACES Delta almost from a new perspective in terms of traditionally, or maybe what he said, and you can correct me if mm-hmm. I'm misremembering, he said that this was kind of the first instance of Mitsubishi Power getting into being part of the development team, mm-hmm. not just selling mm-hmm. in equipment.
Exactly.
And so when you're looking at the energy transition from that being kind of that first step into now, how are you seeing the role of Mitsubishi Power as part of this larger energy transition ecosystem? Mm-hmm.
I think that's a great question and comment. And, you know, MHI, Mitsubishi Power, MHI has been around for 140 years. And when you think about the business model that MHI has brought to bear over that time frame, has been a lot about technology, developing technology, products and solutions, testing, verifying, and bringing those to market over time. So that business model, as you and Mike talked about on the ACES Delta project, is changing a little bit. And part of how MHI and Mitsubishi Power need to have some transformational change and look at different business models. And that's one of the areas that we have been leading is bringing to bear the development business and how do we develop these new technologies. And one of the things we're trying to do is and we have done here at ACES Delta is look at the one-stop shop type of, you can bring the development of the project through execution and operations. So it's hard for one company to do that all by ourselves. And so partnerships have been very important for that out in ACES Delta with a Magnum initially developing the underground salt caverns and using some of their expertise as we worked on that project over almost 5 years ago, pre-IRA, a lot of the before a lot of folks were looking at hydrogen. Mm-hmm. So I think that is a avenue that we're looking at to help bring hydrogen to scale, both as a long-term storage solution as well as a fuel to and hard to abate sectors. But let me go back for one second. I think it's a really good point for maybe your listeners to hear is if you think about the decarbonization goals that we want to try to set to get to net zero by 2050, it's a very challenging task. Mm-hmm. If you think about our current carbon-based infrastructure, it's taken over 100 years to build. We have less than 30 years to implement a low-carbon infrastructure system. And if you think about the electric grid as an example, and decarbonization example, over the last two decades, the U.S. electric grid has reduced its CO2 emissions by about 40% just by shutting down coal, mm-hmm. replacing with natural gas, adding renewables, short-term storage with batteries, lithium-ion batteries, and now long-term storage with green hydrogen out at ACES Delta, that'll be commercial in 2025. And then the next phase of this decarbonization journey is to bring hydrogen to scale as a fuel and a storage component, and then also looking at carbon capture. So when you look at what are the technologies and solutions that are going to get us to net zero by 2050, it's all of that. And the answer is a little different regionally located. So out in Delta, Utah, we've got this enormous salt dome that could house 100 or so caverns that are the size of the Empire State Building. And if you put 100 caverns out there of energy storage with hydrogen, you could power the entire Western United States. Mm-hmm. And so that's really the lowest form of long-term storage. Mm-hmm. Lowest cost, which is key to this whole equation because yeah. we don't want to drive the cost of electricity up for everybody consuming in the United States. So we've yeah. got to be very conscious. How do we come down that cost curve? And it starts with real projects and bringing the technology into scale. So,
yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a really good point you make when we talk about regionality of how we actually decarbonize, because mm-hmm. ACES Delta is a great opportunity for that storage component. Mm-hmm. But then I think of a place like Illinois, where they have one of the only commercial carbon sequestration wells in the U.S.
Correct.
They don't have any major salt caverns, so they don't have an energy storage component, but they have that CCS component. Mm-hmm. So moving on to that CCS side of it and moving off of ACES Delta, off of energy storage, let's talk about CCS and carbon capture and storage there. I think it's safe to say, from my opinion, we're not quite there with carbon capture in mm-hmm. terms of being able to deploy it and deploy it commercially. Mm-hmm. What are some of the technologies that you see or some of the potential enhancements that need to be done to make to deploy CCS faster?
Great question. And let me step back a minute to tell you a little bit higher strategic plan that, you know, Mitsubishi Heavy Industries and Mitsubishi Power is working on. And it's a three-pillar strategy. First is to create a hydrogen ecosystem, which we have a real project out in the ACES Delta to in our development team in order to realize that. The second is decarbonizing existing infrastructure, and we've got some projects we can talk about that as well. And then the third is creating a CO2 ecosystem, and that's the point you're making here on carbon capture. And we're fully committed to bringing these technologies and enabling our customers to decarbonize and meet that 2050 goal. So we've got a project that we're working on right now. We're in FEED study, and it's in Illinois. And the partnership that we're working with is Warwick Carbon Solutions and ADM, Arthur Daniel Middleton, food processing company there in Illinois, Decatur, Illinois. And so ADM has been in business for over 30 years in this facility, and they have their own coal plant that has generated the electricity and steam that they need for their food processing. And so they're going to shut down that coal plant in 2030, and so they need a way to decarbonize. And so what Broadwing is the project that Warwick and ADM are working together on, and we're supporting this project. This Broadwing project will bring clean electrons and clean steam to ADM. So we'll put in the JAC gas turbine, that same one we talked about, the same one's going to go out in ACES Delta. And we will bring clean electrons, and then we will bring steam through a heat recovery steam generator. And then we will capture, we have the amine technology to capture the CO2. So we'll capture that, and then we'll pipe it over across the street to ADM. And they have already, as you mentioned before, the only two Class 6 wells that have been in operation for 10 years in the United States. And they have permits to drill additional wells and be able to grow the sequestration of CO2 right there. And in 8,000 feet below the surface is Mount Simon, which is a perfect rock formation to store CO2. So it's a little bit like, I mean, I think you can parallel view the hydrogen project out in ACES Delta with 3,000 feet below the ground, a geology formation of salt cavern and salt dome that provides the lowest cost of long-term hydrogen storage. The same thing in Illinois, 8,000 feet below the ground, this salt rock formation that provides the lowest cost of CO2 storage. So those are big impacts to lower that total cost. And so we're bringing to bear technology to capture that CO2. You know, the CO2 in the flue gas of a gas turbine is about 3% of that flue gas. So we've got to go in and capture that and then be able to pipe it over to ADM and let them store it in the ground.
Yeah. Yeah. And for areas that I think as you work into that larger ecosystem, there are going to be overlaps there as well of the hydrogen and the carbon capture space. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about kind of the traditional hydrogen infrastructure, trying to capture carbon there. And as you talk about expanding into hydrogen and not green hydrogen, but using traditional blue hydrogen mm-hmm. or turning traditional hydrogen into blue hydrogen. So I think that is interesting to see those overlaps mm-hmm. where you are separating, as you said, two different projects that have a lot of similar components, mm-hmm. you could also see merging in the next couple of years or tens of years, where we start to get an overall picture of a truly decarbonized net zero economy.
I agree. I think the biggest comment here is maybe the word "and," meaning it's everything. Yeah. It's like your 401k. You got to diversify. You can't put all your eggs in one basket, just green hydrogen or just carbon capture or just blue hydrogen or whatever flavor or color of hydrogen we want to talk about. It's all of it. And that brings me to maybe a point that can exemplify this. We have the world's first hydrogen park in Takasago, Japan, where in that facility, we spent over $50 million to do three main things. One, demonstrate, test, and verify hydrogen production technologies. Two, demonstrate above-ground hydrogen storage. And three, hydrogen utilization, both in our R&D center and a fully commercial 101 combined cycle power plant with same JAC gas turbine. So it's hard to just pick which technology is going to work. So we are developing four different technologies of hydrogen production, pyrolysis, electrolyzers, solid oxide electrolyzer cells, and ADM. All of those technologies, today we don't know which one is going to be the best solution, and it might be a different answer regionally. So we are true to MHI's overall DNA is we always develop, test, and verify before we commercialize a product. So we're doing that at the Hydrogen Park. We have to date two of those technologies running, the electrolyzer and the SOEC, solid oxide electrolyzer cells.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point to make of the diversification and the need to be trying maybe not everything, but you need to try enough things to know what can succeed and what can succeed where.
Mm-hmm.
So I really like that. And as we talk about what can succeed where, there is also this other point that seems to be in the middle, infrastructure integration,
mm-hmm.
and maybe talking about the areas that, well, the one spot that I always think of when I'm thinking about very difficult, hard to abate areas are something like the Slave Craton in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
It is this cold location, doesn't have geothermal, doesn't have sedimentary structures for mm-hmm. any type of geologic storage mm-hmm. of any kind. They're kind of in the middle of a very harsh environment. So maybe that doesn't relate at all, but how does this infrastructure integration component work, and how could that help an area like harsh, cold, kind of resource-poor environments that don't have their own regional opportunities to decarbonize?
I think that's a tough question. I might not be an expert on that, Joseph, Joe, I think when we are looking at solutions to decarbonize, how do we bring new technologies to bear? It's a lot of it has to do with partnerships, and you know, we might not have the answer for everything, but we're committed to working together on a project and bringing those right experts to that project so that as a team, we can solve these tougher problems that are harder to see the easy solution today. So I don't have a direct answer for these difficult locations, but you know, one of the things that it brings to mind of overall decarbonization in challenging areas. So I'll touch on a different one. So Japan as a country doesn't have a lot of natural resources. Mm-hmm. And so decarbonization is challenging in Japan. There are not a lot of renewable PV solar or wind turbine, mm-hmm. A lot of nuclear. But one of the areas to decarbonize for the country of Japan is to provide low carbon fuels from the United States, like e-methane or green ammonia, so we can produce hydrogen here, and maybe in some of these tough locations we can produce lower carbon fuels, and then we can convert them to a transportable fuel, and then import that into Japan or other countries that have a more difficult time or less solutions to decarbonize, and it gives them a way to decarbonize as well globally. So that's one of the things we're focused on is, yes, decarbonizing in the country of the United States, but also looking how do we decarbonize in other areas that are harder to decarbonize, to kind of to your point earlier.
Yeah, I think that's a really good viewpoint, and the way you explained it and using Japan as an example was very helpful. And later I'm going to have another guest from Mitsubishi, and not focused on the Americas, but I think it will touch on this idea, looking at the opportunities here in the US, mm-hmm. how you're developing technologies here to solve specific challenges. And then I think the most important part that you were alluding to and outright saying, taking that information, transferring it to other areas to help them decarbonize, and building out these energy ecosystems with a focus on providing that reliable, resilient, low carbon power that we're all looking for as we talk about net zero goals and decarbonization into the future.
Absolutely.
So with that, I think that is a good spot to transition into my final questions. Sure. So these are questions I always ask all of my guests. So that first question being, what is a favorite book of yours that you would recommend?
Oh, I love that. Thank you for that one, Jess. If there's one business book to read, it's called The Advantage. It is my senior staff, every quarter we go through some improving on leadership knowledge, and this book is a book that really does a good job to talk about culture and meeting KPIs and how to organize your company to be successful, and so basically The Advantage stands for, if you have the right team and culture, then that's the advantage that your company can have over other companies. So it's a very good book. I've delivered to my entire senior staff.
Yeah, that sounds like a great one, and I will add it to the list. Hopefully it's on audiobook that I can listen to on the ride home. So now the next question, how do we get to net zero and beyond?
Very good question. And I think we've got almost 9,000 folks here at SARA talking about that challenge. And, you know, I think it is, as I mentioned earlier, it's about it's finding all of the technology solutions, developing those, and then working together to help realize those. So the U.S. government with the IRA and the BIL has really been an accelerant to allow tech innovation and companies to invest in technology. And if I just take a moment to talk about history, another good example is if you look back at renewables 20 years ago, wind and solar were very expensive, but we had a lot of tax incentives that the U.S. government brought to bear for those technologies. And we've come down that cost curve. Innovation manufacturing has improved over time. So I kind of see us in the same point with the hydrogen, both all flavors of hydrogen and carbon capture as well. These technologies are kind of at that same point, higher cost today than what we need them to be over time to fully displace fossil fuels, And so we need to come down that cost curve. We've got U.S. government helping fund some of that to bring real projects. We've got two hydrogen hubs that we're involved in, High Velocity here in Houston, and Pacific Northwest Hydrogen Hub we're involved in. So we'll have real projects that we can have some funding to help bring those to realization, just like the ACES Delta project. So I think it is overall working together to find those technologies and solutions, and then bringing those real projects to bear and trying to do everything we can to reduce the risks as we are very conscious of bringing the cost down. You know, these clean solution needs to be cost effective as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I couldn't agree more that it is going to require that developing the tech, fitting it where we developed it for that use case, mm-hmm. and then finding out where else it can help decrease costs. I really like that. So now the last question, you get to ask me a question.
Okay, sure. I guess, Joseph, you've been here at Sarah this week. What do you feel is as kind of the biggest sentiment that's going on or message that you think we should all be talking about for this year versus maybe last year?
Yeah. So this year, what I've been getting, and so a little bit of background, in case people are just hearing this episode, I've been in the geothermal industry for my day job for mm-hmm. 15 years.
Yeah.
So I am coming from what is a smaller portion, and I would say a forgotten portion, of the renewable energy mix and kind of energy in general. And so so that is background. And what I've been hearing mostly here is almost a pushback saying we need reliable, resilient power. And I couldn't agree more. Mm-hmm. I think there is a point that you made that we need to be also developing technologies so that we have an opportunity and we have the commercial technologies and the path to profitability in the next 5 to 10 years. We shouldn't just stop everything. We should be developing everything together. And so the sentiment that I've been hearing is more natural gas, more LNG, stop stopping us.
Right.
And I agree. I think we also need the carbon capture, and we also need the hydrogen opportunities, so that once you have LNG to a place like Japan, mm-hmm. they have the technology to convert that to hydrogen, capture that carbon, and then they can put the carbon in the boat and send it back to somewhere where it's going to go and get sequestered.
Right.
We need all of it together. We can't just do it stepwise and we can't do it stepwise and chronological. Mm-hmm. We need to be doing it iteratively and tangentially.
Totally agree. And I think the Secretary of the DOE also mentioned geothermal. Yeah. And that there's real projects going on that. We're looking at that as well. We've got TurboDen is another organization that we're working on and ownership of that, Mitsubishi Heavy. And so there are other, again, it's kind of that and. It's all of it. And we need to work the technology side of it and work the cost side of it. And getting some help from the U.S. government helps bring those projects to realization.
Yep, absolutely. Well, Bill, thank you for joining me on the show today. Before we sign off, is there anything else you'd like to say?
I appreciate this opportunity. The energy transition is something we're working every day on as a company fully invested in it. And it's one of the main things it's going to take is all of us working together to accomplish this. So I look forward to that opportunity. And one of the words used was cooperation. So traditional competitors are now partnering together to cooperate for the same common goal. And I think that's what's really inspiring, is that, you know, we're all kind of rolling up our sleeves trying to realize the same common goal. So I'm excited about continuing to wake up every day to make that happen.
Yeah, I like that. I like coopetition.
Coopetition, so, yeah.
Yeah, well, thank you again for joining me, and thank you everyone for joining us on this episode of the Energy Transition Solutions Podcast. If you're enjoying the show, share it with a friend and leave a review telling me what you're enjoying most or what you'd like to hear more of. If you want more news and energy-related stories, we have all sorts of energy-related podcasts on OGGN. You can find them by connecting with us on LinkedIn or visiting the website. Finally, if you have any questions, comments, corrections, or have a story that you would like to share, send me an email. That email address is joe.battier@oggn.com. If you don't use email, find me on LinkedIn. And until next time, remember to keep it low carbon and high energy.
Join us again next week for another low carbon, high energy story on the Energy Transition Solutions Podcast, a production of the Oil and Gas Global Network. Learn more at oggn.com.